Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have spent a couple of weeks on Yahukon in 3. We've been doing it because of a conversation that Kirk and his wife Terry had with a Christian, where the Christian was receptive to, open to, the truth about Yahweh, about his covenant, about his Torah, all the way up to the point where it said that to participate in the covenant as a man, to engage in Pesach, Passover, as a man, which is the doorway to life, you need to be circumcised. To enter heaven, according to God, you need to be circumcised. And he says, no, 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 I'm going to just cling to John 3:16. And so my issue with that has always been that, A, it's not John, it's Yahukonin. B, the accuracy of the testimony in the so-called Christian New Testament is gargantuanly suspect. There are more variations than there are words. And number three, that the conversations took place in Hebrew and they're recorded in Greek and then translated into English, and that language is not only imperfect, but when you translate from one language to another, there is so many possibilities that you go from imperfect to significantly different. And then you've got the biggest issue of all. Context, context, context. When Yosha told Nicodemus about God giving his son for the express purpose of eternal life and trusting him, it was in the context of a conversation. And yet, the Christian will ignore all of that conversation. So we actually do have Kirk today. We also have Glenn still with us, and happy to have either one of you chime in. But Kirk, I thought you were working today.
Well, I was actually working yesterday, but I called in right before I went to work, and today I don't work till this afternoon, so.
Okay. Well, good to have you back. You've probably heard what I'm doing is I wanted to summarize the biggest issues of quoting John 3:16. Mm-hmm. And there are many, you know, one of which is that the Christian New Testament is stunningly unreliable. I mean, it's so unreliable. And you only have two eyewitness accounts, and they're written by Matanya and Yahukonin. Matanya means Yah is giving, and Yahukonin means Yah is merciful. And we've changed it to Gospels of Matthew and John. So we've completely changed the concept. We put them in a New Testament when there is no New Testament. And God's really clear about this. There is no New Testament. So we put them in a book that is considered a Christian New Testament when God doesn't have a New Testament. And with Yahukonin in particular, it was so heavily edited that it's become among the least trustworthy, not because of Yahukonin, but because of the editors of what he wrote, them adding to it and taking away from it. And then you've got the issue of Yahukonin spoke and wrote Hebrew. This conversation that Yosha was having with Nicodemus was in Hebrew, and we find it in Greek, and then we translate it into English. And oh my goodness, the changes along the way. For example, Yosha most certainly used the terminology that he uses throughout the Torah, aman, trust and rely, based upon that which is knowable and verifiable, because he's speaking throughout this on teaching. And so when you teach, you learn. When you learn, you're in a position to understand. When you understand, you can trust and rely. They're all related concepts. They permeate the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. And so aman was translated as pistis, which means to trust and rely, but it changed over time to mean believe and faith because of Paul's use of it. It was Paul's favorite term. He presented it as a belief concept. Well, belief has nothing to do with understanding, of knowing, of trusting, of relying. It's the antithesis of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got that issue of the language, and then of course the biggest issue of all, the issue that we've spent 3 weeks on,
mm-hmm.
context.
Yeah.
Turns out that that the answer Yosho was giving to Nicodemus, and the man's name was could have been anything, but it most certainly was not Nicodemus. So we have an issue there. By the way, a friend who's an avid listener to the program wrote me and said that Nicodemus means a conqueror of the people. And I associate it with the Greek god of victory, Nike, which is the basis of the Nicene Council. The Greek town of Nicaea was named after the Greek god of victory. To conquer and to be victorious are the same concept. So it's the reason that Nicodemus is thought to be conqueror of the people is that to conquer is to be victorious. And so the Greek god of victory was the Greek god of military conquest.
Mm-hmm.
And most certainly no one who was a rabbi would have had that name because it has the name of a Greek god emblazoned in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
But what we find here, Kirk, is that the context of Yosha's discussion destroys Christianity every which way. I mean, you came up with a list of like somewhere between 10 and 20, and those were just the highlights of how his discussion with this man, every aspect of it, including why he was in town, including his first act, which was to get rid of the monetarization of those making merchandise of men in the house of God.
Yeah, the business of religion.
The business of religion. I mean, that's the first thing that he trashed, and then he was there for Passover. And then this whole thing is about the fulfillment of the Torah's promise of Passover and him being Torah observant and him observing Passover and then him telling Nicodemus, what's wrong with you? Why would you ask me these questions? You're a teacher. You know, a teacher in Israel, you ought to know the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these answers are in the Torah. And here in particular is the family of God, which is the covenant.
You know, one of the things, one of the things that struck me after the conversation yesterday, and some people were questioning some things, and they decided that we go to a rabbi or an expert.
Yes.
And you have a dialogue here where, first of all, Yahweh doesn't approve of rabbis.
No.
There is no such thing. There wasn't an order of rabbis. I mean,
it's
Lowy, which is a totally different animal.
Right.
The rabbis are not experts on the Torah. That's obvious when you talk to Nicodemus. They were the Talmud.
Right.
Yosha didn't endorse rabbis. He rebukes Nicodemus.
Right.
And where did he tell Nicodemus to go find the real answers?
The Torah.
Now he said
in fact, right before this comment on John 3:16, it's a direct reference to Moshe. And every time that Yosha mentions Moshe, it's about the Torah, and it's an act in the Torah that is analogous to Passover that he references in terms of trusting and relying upon the Son that Yah was sent to do what? To fulfill the Torah's promise regarding Passover. Because each of the first four Moed Mikre, invitations to be called out and meet with God, each of the four provide the benefits of the covenant, of the family of God. And so he had to fulfill those first four because they provide the express benefits of the covenant. And so that's the whole conversation here. And he's saying, you don't get it. I mean, you just flat out don't understand it. And this was the scholar.
Yeah. Did Yosha recruit any rabbis to run around with him?
No.
No.
No, in fact, you know, in that argument that was being used against me with the five scholars to me as the amateur over a prefix pronoun, not over translation, over a prefix pronoun. While I'm upset that the tone of the response was designed expressly to demean me and to discredit everything we have done. So it was done to be mean-spirited. The realization is that, Kirk, you're an amateur at this.
I'm very amateur. Ranking.
I am an amateur at this. And, you know, the only reason that we can engage productively with Yanoa, and the only reason that your list of insights and your analysis of this is meaningful is because you're not a professional scholar. If you were, you would be useless to God. Yeah, your point is exactly right. He picked 12 disciples. Were any of them scholars?
No.
Were any of them Hebrew scholars?
Not a one.
Did in all of the individuals that he chose to reveal himself through and to engage with throughout the long process of presenting us with the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, did he go to any Hebrew scholar? Did he go to any academician and say, "You're my guy, you're smarter than everybody else? Boy, I think I'm going to work through you"?
Even Dode was the lowly little brother stuck out in the field.
Right.
I didn't even think he was well good enough to even present to the
right.
prophet.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. Yeah, the lowly little discarded brother that everyone wanted to pass by. You know, he liked to play his harp.
Mm-hmm.
He liked to think and write songs. And yeah, it's the story all the way through. Was Abraham presented as a bigwig in Ur?
Hardly.
Was he a politician in Ur? Was he a military leader in Ur? Was he an academician? Was he a teacher? Was he a scholar?
Did anybody miss him when he left?
No. And that's really what's so interesting about this is that, Nicodemus was adversarial to Yahweh, to his Torah, to Yahusha, and that is why Yahweh is constantly demeaning him. He's saying, you know, what's wrong with you? You know, you're positioning yourself as a teacher to Israel, and you don't know this. And he says, you know, I'm trying to explain the mundane to you. And you don't get the mundane. How in the hell are you going to understand spiritual things if you don't even grasp the mundane? And that, to me, is the difference between knowing and understanding. And I will tell you, the scholars are those who know many things and seem to understand nothing. I'd rather understand than know. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Kirk, I understand that the term a scholar is someone who is schooled, but aren't those that are considered to be the best scholars typically professors with PhDs?
Mm-hmm.
And aren't the professors with PhDs the teachers?
Yes.
Whose teaching do you consider to be useful and reliable?
Everything in the Torah, but very few other PhDs in the Torah.
Yeah, Yahweh. You would view Yahweh as a creator,
a lot better. Yeah.
Is your as a teacher, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you're happy to learn from Yahweh.
Absolutely.
I am happy to learn from Yahweh. I'm happy to learn from Yahusha because Yahusha is a diminished manifestation of Yahweh. Yahusha is teaching us through Yahochanan, the end of Yahochanan 2 and into Yahochanan 3. He is teaching us. I like learning from him.
Mm-hmm.
And so from Yahweh and Yahusha, we can be students and we can learn and we can come to understand. It's a worthy use of our time, an enjoyable use of our time, a hugely beneficial use of our time.
Mm-hmm. Well, he told you that's what we should be doing.
Yes, but when it comes to men teaching, what did Yahusha have to say about the testimony of men in this very discussion?
What he said, I don't trust him at all to do.
There you go,
huh? Big indictment,
yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty good indictment.
Yeah.
Yes. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, there are some pitfalls here, of course, as always, because we humans grow up socialized, that's the thing. But I'm sure you're familiar with this phenomenon. Certainly, you know, many people have learned to have a healthy suspicion of you know, egg-headed intellectuals, the white-collar know-it-alls.
Mm-hmm.
But having done some time in evangelicalism,
yes.
I'm sure you're familiar with the backlash phenomenon of the proudly ignorant blue-collar know-it-all.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be almost as problematic.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's the stick your heels in. Well, you know, if it was good enough for Paul and Silas, if it's good enough for me. And it's like,
yeah,
I'm just going to sing to John 3:16. You know, there's nothing wrong with learning or being.
But that's not thinking. It's just spewing out an opinion, particularly when you quote something errantly out of context. And you're right.
Oh, yeah.
I would agree that the problem exists on both sides. On one side, my people are destroyed for lack of knowing, and because they have rejected the Torah, I will reject their children. Citing Hosea 4:6, but. In the case of the blue collar problem, it's surely ignorance. It's ignorance blended with some indoctrinated irrationality because of political correctness.
There are people who don't. So I'm not going to pay attention to original languages. Well, you can't very well get to the Moed Mikri something of the original languages.
That is correct.
On
the other side, of course, you've got the intellectuals who are part of the professors who are indoctrinating people not to to think.
Well, who gives a PhD a PhD? It's another PhD. If he doesn't approve you, you don't get passed.
Right. And in education, there is a religion associated with education. I mean, there is a dogma and a mantra. And if you are not an avid proponent of political correctness and as a teacher, you are not going to get your PhD from other PhDs.
Right. Yeah. And so the foolishness is piled higher and deeper. PhD.
Yeah, it is true. Yeah, it is. It is a problem. What we're talking about too is, folks, at the end of our program yesterday, I responded to a email who wanted to discredit all of the many thousands of pages, probably 7,000 pages of translations of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, an analysis that I have provided over the last decade or so, because five Hebrew scholars, and I think this is probably an exaggeration, but the claim was five Hebrew scholars said that collectively that the prefixed pronoun that was rendered in the first person, the third person singular masculine, had to be converted to plural, and that my translations were errant because of the application of the prefixed third person singular masculine pronoun. Mind you, the words were all translated more accurately than the scholars had done in their published translations, but not the pronoun, and for that, total discredit. This sort of reminds me of a scenario. Let's take Einstein's paper on relativity. You know, he wrote a paper on special and general relativity. And they published the same year he's working as an amateur, because he was actually a professional in the post office. And he came up with the concepts of time is relative, depending on your speed or velocity or perspective from great concentration of mass. And he came up with the idea that energy and matter were the same thing, just different amounts of the same thing equals mc squared, and a number of other brilliant insights. And so in those papers, I am quite certain that somewhere in those papers there's a punctuation error and probably a verb subject to disagreement. And it would be like the scholar saying, we're going to reject all of this. First of all, we're not comfortable with it because it's contrary to the accepted paradigm. But because it's amateurish, it was written by a non-professional physicist, and there are some subject-verb disagreements.
Yeah, that's about what they would say.
Yeah, that's about the equivalent of having five scholars say that you, in our collective opinion, you have rendered a prefixed third person a singular pronoun as singular, when the singular pronoun really ought to be and must be rendered as plural. And regardless of the fact that the rest of this is accurately conveyed and extraordinarily insightful, we'll just dismiss the whole thing as amateurish because, well, we don't like the paradigm that you're exposing.
I came across a one-line translation,
mm-hmm.
and I put it, paralleled it with the one that's used in every Christian church all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's different between what Yahweh actually said and what they say, and it's and it actually comes from Numbers, and that kind of tickled me because you and Glenn a while back were kidding, you know, the one book in the Torah that's hard is Numbers.
Yeah, I know.
Well,
I
when
know.
We did when we put this together.
Well, by the way, that upright Moshe lifting the serpent on the upright pole. Yeah, that does come from Numbers.
Well, that's what I would like, because Glenn's here, and I thought we kind of tease him a little bit. If you will allow me, let me read the Christian version that everybody's familiar with.
Sure.
And I'll read you the other version.
The scholar version.
And see what? It's a very short.
Okay.
It's the English version, and they say this all the time. It says, "The Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord will make his face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. And the Lord lift up the countenance upon thee and give thee peace." Now, let's see what I think he said.
Yeah.
"Yahweh will kneel before you, presenting gifts, and guard you with a hedge of protection. Yahweh will illuminate the wholeness of his beings towards you in bringing order, and he will provide you with love, sustenance, and friendship. Yahweh will lift up his wholeness of being and look upon you, and he will set in place all you need to be whole and complete." And, of course, the words of Barak and Yahweh, Shamar. If you look them all up, instead of gracious, it's Chanan. I mean, the difference in those two, with all the lords and all the gratias, and you can't trust any of these Christian things. I mean,
I'm going to tell you, Kirk,
uh-huh.
That was one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard.
Well, that's what Tara and I did. Now, I didn't translate it. I found this translation, and then I just looked up every one of the words, just the same way I do you.
Yeah.
And that's the most. And it became my favorite verse, and I got so tickled because I looked at it and I said, "This is Numbers."
Wow.
And then I remember y'all giving.
So the scholars didn't get anything right.
They got nothing right.
Nothing right. Nothing.
And
so the same scholars that would be critical of the prefixed pronoun
mm-hmm.
didn't get anything right.
Nothing.
And what you did with the Terry being your wife,
right.
you looked at the letters, the jots and the tittles, as Yosha instructed us. You looked at the words not only in the construction, the letters that comprise the words and what they tell us, but you also looked up the words themselves to find their root meaning, which you almost always find in the actionable form, the verbal form of the word will tell you what it means. And rendered it based upon that. And
I don't want to get credit for this. I mean, somebody else did this, but I ran across it, and then I looked up every word, you know, and then every letter and to confirm it. And I said, boy, that is...
I don't know who wrote that, but it is...
You know, I was going to send it to you and say, if you can find something wrong with this, I can't find it.
No, in fact, what I'd like to know is who provided the translation.
Well, I'll email you on the guy, and you can, you know. This is a guy who translates, but he also is kind of, he sells his stuff, but he's selling to a Christian community, so you got to have your perspective on.
Okay.
Because, you know, it's like a lot of them.
The realization, though, it's very few people who recognize that Barak means to kneel down in love.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you hear that, you're that's what Barak means, to kneel down and to lift up in love. Yahweh is the one who kneels down to lift us up. He doesn't want us kneeling down. That's counterproductive. His whole idea is to lift us up, and he gets down on his knees like a loving father to lift us up. And so God on his knees is Yahusha. That is God on his knees lifting us up. It's Yahweh saving us and embracing us. And then the other realization that shalom only in an extreme tortured meaning is peace. It's reconciliation. It's to reconcile a relationship. And so few people who are accepting of the obvious that the letters Yod Heh Wah Heh are Yahweh. I mean, all you have to do is look at the pronunciation of Torah to recognize that that's how those letters are pronounced. All you have to do is look at the pronunciation of Shalom to recognize that that's how those letters are pronounced. Look at the verb that Yahweh said, this is the basis of my name, Haya.
You know, speaking of that, I've even seen it written as Haya, like
Yahweh.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, so I mean, it transliterated that way, so as well.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's a.
So that's a, yeah, that's
out there that know some of this stuff. This is
yeah.
not, but none of them. But this guy, by the way, is not a scholar.
No, you can tell. You would be rejected from these.
Yeah.
You'd be rejected from the scholastic community for not adhering to the mythos, the doctrine of the scholastic community. And so to accurately convey what Yahweh said is to be rejected by the scholars. Did the scribes, who were the scholars of their days, and the Hebrew experts, which would be the Pharisees, did they accept or reject Yahusha?
Rejected him.
And was Yahusha the human manifestation of the word of Yahweh?
Yeah, you couldn't accept him and reject the Torah at the same time. You have to reject both.
Yep. So that's the bottom line. I do want to make a little more progress here on Yahweh Kanan 3.
Sure.
And right before we find him conveying this idea that if you rely upon the Son, you'll have eternal life, and it's life, not salvation in that particular case, predecessor to that statement was Moshe lifting up the serpent as a remedy to the venomous death amid the snakes in the wilderness. And this whole thing was in context of Yahusha being in town to fulfill and to observe Passover, where he was lifted up on the upright pole of Mount Moriah, just as had occurred with the blood of the Passover lamb on the upright pillars of the doorway to life in Egypt, in Mitzrayim, in the crucible. I mean, it's about making connections like this that cause understanding. When you took that constant Christian misquote, I mean, just terrible misquote, horrible misquote of the passage in Numbers, and then looked at it accurately rendered, what you were able to do is to say, I can't trust the Christian sources. I mean, they're not only errant. They're deliberately errant. I mean, this is not a potential grammatical mistake. This is not a subject-verb disagreement. This is not the improper use of a pronoun.
No, this is literal wholesale change.
Wholesale change. Complete religious copy edit of the text. Changed everything. And so when you make the connection between what was actually said and what they are promoting and what they constantly repeat, you're able to say, wait a minute, these people are deliberately deceiving me.
And if you had your choice on the God presented in one and Yahweh presented the other, there's no question.
Look, I would like you to read the translation again because it gave me goosebumps. It flows over me the same way that reinforces everything I know about Yahweh from his Torah. It's a summation of everything that Yahweh has had to share with us in his Torah. Go ahead, please.
Okay. Yahweh will kneel before you presenting gifts and will guard you with a hedge of protection. Yahweh will illuminate the wholeness of his being towards you, bringing order, and he will provide you with love, sustenance, and friendship. Yahweh will lift up his wholeness of being and look upon you, and he will set in place all you need to be whole and complete. Number 6:24-26.
Yeah.
Mark.
That wholeness of being is from Pene, and Pene is can be rendered face, as it is in the English version. But 99 times out of 100, it is very awkwardly conveyed as face, and is very appropriately conveyed as presence. And it's Pene is a unique concept of presence. It means the immediate presence of an individual, their immediate proximity to you, them coming into very close contact with you. So that's the Pene is the concept of presence, and that kind of presence is extrapolated as being face to face. So Pene is often rendered face, but it is much more accurately conveyed as the fullness of one's presence and one's immediate proximity.
Right.
That's the difference between looking at the words and rendering them completely and as accurately as possible. And not it, but even the face is usable if it's face to face, looking at you directly face to face and not turning away. This next statement in Yaokanan 3 is powerful. It says, whoever relies upon him is not separated, judged, or condemned. Krino. But in that, the primary meaning of krino is to separate. And it's used in the concept of either being set apart from or set apart to, being included in or separated distance from. Krino. So whoever relies upon him is not separated. But whoever does not rely stands separated already because he has not trusted in the proper name of God's one and only Son. So I would ask you, Kirk, on behalf of your friend that was speaking with your wife and who says, I'm going to disregard all that Torah stuff, and I'm just going to cling to John 3:16. And in Yaokanan 3:16, of course, Yosha is speaking on behalf of the very God that authored the Torah that your friend is rejecting. But beyond that, are you aware of any Christian who relies on the personal and proper name of God's one and only Son?
I knew Yahweh and didn't even, but I didn't know Yosha.
Yeah.
I mean, and then we rejected it as being meaningful.
Is there any part of the name Jesus that is accurate?
Well, only if you're worshiping Zeus.
Well, beyond the fact that the "us" ending is to change
it
from feminine to masculine using Greek grammar rules, but he's not a Greek, so why would you use Greek grammar rules to change the name from feminine to masculine? You know, both Yahweh and Yosha in the Greek language would be feminine. Just the "ah" ending or the "ain" ending are feminine in Greek. So what? They're not Greek names.
Well, why is it, I think you pointed this out one time, and why is it that they can do every pagan king and every pagan person, and they can't transliterate the people?
You know, Yahweh wrote his own name 7,000 times in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And he comprised his name using three of the 22 letters that are regularly translated, regularly spoken, pronounced in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. The three letters in his name are part of the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. How is it we can pronounce every word in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms written with those 22 letters, and we can't pronounce Yahweh's name?
And it's just a stupid argument. I mean, of course you can't.
You know, two of the three letters are in the word Torah. We have no problem pronouncing Torah, do we?
No, sir.
The other letter is the first letter of Yisrael, the Yod. We don't have any problem pronouncing it, do we?
No.
No. So, and then when we, by the way, would you think that the architect of life, the fellow that came up with DNA as a language, would be able to spell his own name?
I would suspect so.
Would you call him a scholar? Would you call him an expert in Hebrew?
I think he knows it. If you think.
Okay. So you think probably he could spell his own name, and he spelled it consistently 7,000 times in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Now, the name of the son shares the first three letters. You know, there's four letters in Yahweh's name.
Mm-hmm.
One is repeated, so it's Yod He Wah He. And the son's name, the Yod, the He, and the Wah, are included.
Mm-hmm.
So that should give you a clue that it's Yahweh.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's probably 50 Hebrew names. Like Yoel, like Job, Job, and Joel, that convey the Ya'o sound as a contraction. Now, the second half of the name, Yahweh writes that name 220 times in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. In fact, the first time the name appears, he's going up on Mount Moriah to receive, be part of the celebration of the reception of the Torah. And that name is Yahweh with two letters, the Shin and the Ein. Basis is the contraction of Yasha, the Hebrew word for salvation. And so it's Yahusha. It's not difficult to figure this stuff out, is it?
No, not to me.
No. You're an amateur, and so am I. And yet we can look at the letters that comprise these words and not only pronounce them, but explain them.
Yeah, very plainly.
Very clearly. It's a good teacher.